you're tuning in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat, Sylvester, and band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening and welcome to Trans Positive. Tonight we're going to be discussing the current genocide of trans people. So trigger warning, we'll be talking about some very dark stuff. Let's go around and introduce ourselves real quick and then we'll get into the topic. My name is Nicolette and I use they, them, am, or fey, fair pronouns.
My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Carter and I use they, them.
Hi, Sheila, she, her.
All right. Thank you for being here, everyone. So the purpose of this show is to explain how a genocide happens, how it is happening to trans people right now, and what can be done to prevent it. So to start, what is a genocide? The dictionary definition of genocide is the deliberate killing of a large number of people from a particular nation or ethnic group with the aim of destroying that nation or group. The United Nations definition of genocide is a crime committed with the intent to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. While trans people may not fit under these specific categories, trans people are a group. We are a minority population. And thus, the mass killing of trans people and/or the intent to destroy trans people as a whole would count as a genocide. Now, Gregory H. Stanton, a research professor in genocide studies and prevention and the founding president and chairman of Genocide Watch, wrote a 10-step guide to a genocide based on how genocides have happened throughout history. Because the mass killing of a group doesn't just suddenly happen. There are steps that lead up to that happening, as history has shown. In Nazi Germany, for example, the systematic destruction of the Jewish and other minority populations was a slow process with several steps to it that ended in the camps and the firing squads. It didn't just happen instantly. So if that's how a genocide ends, how does it begin? That's where the 10 stages of genocide come into play. Stanton writes, "Genocide is a process that develops in 10 stages that are predictable but not inexorable. At each stage, preventive measures can stop it. The process is not linear. Stages may occur simultaneously. Logically, later stages must be preceded by earlier stages, but all stages continue to operate throughout the process. Stage one is classification, meaning all cultures have categories to distinguish people into us and them. Bipolar societies that lack mixed categories, such as Rwanda and Burundi, are the most likely to have genocide. we already have this classification as transgender and cisgender. You're either trans or you're cis. This leads transphobes to have an us versus them mentality, to see us as an other category or a different classification of human, rather than seeing trans as just a descriptor. The main preventive measure for this stage is to develop universalistic institutions that transcend divisions, that actively promote tolerance and understanding, and that promote classifications that transcend these divisions, such as saying, despite our differences, we are both human. Or maybe something like, despite the differences between trans women and cis women, both are women. This search for common ground is vital to early prevention of genocide. Stage two is symbolization, meaning we give names or symbols to these classifications. We name people things like Jews or gypsies and distinguish them by colors or dress and apply these symbols to members of groups. Classification and symbolization are universally human and do not necessarily result in genocide unless they lead to dehumanization. When combined with hatred, symbols may be forced upon unwilling members of pariah groups, such as the yellow star for Jews under the Nazi rule. We do, for example, have the trans flag as a symbol, and we choose to wear that symbol with pride, but it would be all too easy for someone to force all trans people to wear a trans flag pin or something like that in order to identify us. To combat symbolization, hate symbols such as the swastika in Germany can be legally forbidden, as can hate speech. The problem is that legal limitations will fail if unsupported by popular cultural enforcement, such as when code words replaced Hutu and Tutsi when those words were banned in Burundi. If widely supported, however, denial of symbolization can be powerful, as it was in Bulgaria, where the government refused to supply enough yellow badges, and at least 80% of Jews did not wear them, depriving the yellow star of its significance as the Nazi symbol for Jews. Stage three is discrimination. This is when a dominant group uses law, custom, and political power to deny the rights of other groups. The dominant group is driven by an exclusionary ideology that would deprive the less powerful of their rights. The ideology advocates for monopolization and expansion of power by the dominant group and legitimizes the victimization of weaker groups. Now, we've talked plenty on this show about all the laws being pushed forward right now to deny the rights of trans people, like denying our right to health care, banning us from public restrooms, banning us from participating in sports, allowing trans children to be kidnapped. Even this anti-drag bill that's already causing people to be arrested for being trans in public. There are currently at least 270 anti-trans bills in the U.S. proposed in 2023. I think there may be more than that now, actually. That is how discriminated against we are. Prevention against discrimination means full political empowerment and citizenship rights to all groups in a society. Discrimination based on nationality, ethnicity, race, or religion should be outlawed, and I think we need to include sexuality and gender identity under that as well. Individuals should have the right to sue the state, corporations, and other individuals if their rights are violated. Stage four is dehumanization. This is when one group denies the humanity of the other group. Members of the targeted group are equated with animals, vermin, insects, or diseases. Dehumanization overcomes the normal human revulsion against murder. At this stage, hate propaganda in print and on radios or TV is used to vilify the victim group. The majority group is taught to regard the other group as less than human and even alien to their society. They are indoctrinated to believe we are better off without them. The powerless group are equated with filth, impurity, and immorality. Hate speech fills the propaganda of official radio, newspapers, and speeches. So yes, we have transphobes comparing us to animals, from literally calling us animals to, for example, Matt Walsh's children's book, where he compared trans children to children being forcibly turned into animals by doctors. We have transphobes calling us a disease, such as this social contagion idea where they believe that being exposed to trans people will turn people trans. We have transphobes calling us dirty and immoral. We have transphobes portraying us as villains and predators. We have transphobes saying we're not even human. We have transphobes saying society would be better off without trans people and that transgenderism should be eradicated. And all of this is being spewed in propaganda in the news, such as Fox News, or by speakers such as Matt Walsh, Michael Knowles, Ben Shapiro, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and more. To combat dehumanization, incitement to genocide should not be confused with protected speech. Local and international leaders should condemn the use of hate speech and make it culturally unacceptable. Leaders who incite genocide should be banned from international travel and have their foreign finances frozen. Hate radio stations or TV stations should be shut down and hate propaganda banned. Hate crimes and atrocities should be promptly punished. Stage 5 is organization. Genocide is always organized, usually by the state, often using militias to provide deniability of state responsibility. Sometimes organization is informal or decentralized. We are seeing this against trans people here in the U.S. by organizations like the KKK or the Proud Boys, going to pride events and drag shows with the intent of violence. To combat the organization stage, membership in genocidal militias should be outlawed. Their leaders should be denied visas for foreign travel and have their foreign assets frozen. The UN should impose arms embargoes on governments and citizens of countries involved in genocidal massacres and create commissions to investigate violations and use national legal systems to prosecute those who violate such embargoes. Stage 6 is polarization. This means extremists drive the groups apart. Hate groups broadcast polarizing propaganda. Motivations for targeting a group are indoctrinated through mass media. Extremist terrorism targets moderates, intimidating and silencing the center. Like I mentioned before, we are seeing polarizing propaganda in major news organizations like Fox News and the Daily Wire, accusing not just trans people of being villains and predators, but also anyone who supports them. Prevention may mean security protection for moderate leaders or assistance to human rights groups. Assets of extremists may be seized and visas for international travel denied to them. Stage 7 is preparation. This is when plans are made for genocidal killings. National or perpetrator group leaders plan the final solution to the targeted group in question. They often use euphemisms to cloak their intentions, such as referring to their goals as ethnic cleansing, purification, or counterterrorism. They indoctrinate the populace with fear of the victim group. Leaders often claim that if we don't kill them, they will kill us, disguising genocide as self-defense. There is a sudden increase in inflammatory rhetoric and hate propaganda with the objective of creating fear of the other group. We see this in the rhetoric about protecting children from trans people or protecting women's spaces from trans people, or the recent claim that trans people are dangerous because of the shooting in Nashville by an apparent trans man. There's all sorts of propaganda right now painting all trans people as dangerous and something to fear. Prevention of preparation may include arms embargoes and commissions to enforce them. It should include prosecution of incitement and conspiracy to commit genocide. Stage 8 is persecution. This is when victims are identified and separated out because of their identity. Death lists are drawn up. In state-sponsored genocide, members of victim groups may be forced to wear identifying symbols. Their property is often expropriated. Sometimes they may even be segregated into ghettos, deported into concentration camps, or confined to a famine-struck region and starved. They are deliberately deprived of resources such as food or water to slowly destroy them. Programs are implemented to prevent procreation through forced sterilization or abortions. Children are forcibly taken from their parents. The victim group's basic human rights are systematically abused through extrajudicial killings, torture, and forced displacement. We are seeing this in multiple countries around the world where, by law, in order for a trans person to transition, they are forced to be sterilized. The reality is the U.S. could soon implement this law too, because many Republicans are advocating for the forced sterilization of trans people. Already in the U.S., we have courts forcibly removing children from trans parents and bills allowing children to be kidnapped from trans parents. We have trans people who have no choice but to live in ghettos because no other housing will accept them. We have Transgender Day of Remembrance because of all the trans people who are murdered every year. This stage is happening right now. At this stage, a genocide emergency must be declared. If the political will of the great powers, regional alliances, or the UN Security Council can be mobilized, armed international intervention should be prepared or heavy assistance provided to the victim group to prepare for self-defense. Humanitarian assistance should be organized by the UN and private relief groups for the inevitable tide of refugees to come. Let me repeat, at this stage where we are at right now, a genocide emergency must be declared. Stage 9 is where the actual extermination begins and quickly becomes the mass killing legally called genocide. It is extermination to the killers because they do not believe their victims to be fully human. Acts of genocide demonstrate how dehumanized their victims have become. In total genocides, all members of the targeted group are exterminated. At this stage, only rapid and overwhelming armed intervention can stop genocide. Real safe areas or refugee escape corridors should be established with heavily armed international protection. If strong nations will not provide troops to intervene directly, they should provide the airlifts, equipment, and financial means necessary for regional states to intervene. Denial is the 10th and final stage that lasts throughout and always follows genocide. The perpetrators dig up the mass graves, burn the bodies, try to cover up the evidence, and intimidate the witnesses. They deny that they committed any crimes and often blame what happened on the victims. They block investigations of the crimes and continue to govern until driven out of power by force. As you can see, we are on at least stage 8, and stages 9 and 10 could easily happen if we don't address this right now. The reality is we are in real danger if we don't do something. All of these steps are preventable, and we need to implement these preventions in order to prevent our genocide. It is time to contact our politicians, and it is time to declare a genocide emergency. Would anyone like to share their thoughts?
I come from an era when micro versions of this were already present. When I first came out in the 80s, what was astonishing to me was how differently I could be treated during transition than I was treated before, even though it was in my same neighborhood. And one of the things that appalled me most is that I could go into, say, a pizza parlor or something like that, and a kid would jump up from a table and come over and say some horrible, opprobrious term towards me, and the parents would do nothing about it. And I was thinking, wait a minute, I'm in my 30s. I'm a grown up, and this has gone on. Can you even imagine a family simply ignoring this and giving therefore permission to do it? So that sense of invisibility was already present. In those days, I won't mention the exact mall, but there was actually a head of security who simply said, "This is private property. We do not allow any cross-dressed people in the mall, period. If you show up, we'll arrest you." And this was the situation that prevailed. So that already using legal things to go after us, but then those were the days where we were seen as being such a micro minority that it wouldn't even matter. And so what bothers me today is that the type of language that's being used against us always portrays us as being the bad guys. We're the ones that are, in a sense, raiding their culture as though they own a culture. They own American culture. They own American mores. And the idea is that somehow or other, we are the aggressors. And what's very troublesome to me lately is that rather than being seen as a complex clinical entity and therefore being within the zone of the privacy of our dealing with the doctors or the people that are dealing with us, I was happy in a way that we don't pathologize being transgender in that it is not considered a mental illness per se. It's rather the pain of undergoing the transgender situation that is identified, just as depression would be identified as not being a mental illness, like somebody is a mentally unbalanced person, but rather that they are suffering from a diagnosable pain, and therefore gender transition is a treatment among many that is most effective in dealing with our pain. So that keeps it within the realm of the clinical. That's not the way it's being portrayed right now. We are portrayed as being a cultural force that is interfering with freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, invading spaces that are not our own, into which we are not entitled to enter. And all of these types of narratives have completely almost obliterated the idea that transition should be a very private affair. And then those of us who find, either because of personal problems of dealing with the stresses of transition, are becoming known as detransitioners, are being used as a way to undercut the entire phenomenon and to say, well, that just proves it was a phony deal in the beginning. It was a sociological construct. And if we could just sit there and stamp it out, we're not stamping people out, we're stamping out a condition. But I think any transgender person feels that far more is at stake than something that is just peripheral to our personalities. We feel that this is something deep inside of us, and it basically foregoes the ability that we should have to be able to go for some medical aid if we feel that that's appropriate. And it's as though, this is another thing that has always bothered me. A lot of people will say, well, prove how serious you are. Have you had your final surgery? Have you had bottom surgery? Well, if you haven't, you haven't really put it on the line. You're basically not, you're kind of trying to keep your foot in both camps, forcing us therefore into a binary perspective that some of us don't share. And so what's intriguing is that no matter what we do, there's always some little angle that they can use to attack our existence. And that is the genocide that we're experiencing. Plus the fact that some of us, even though it's not all of us, do pay the ultimate price of actually being killed on the street, which we deal with every year at the Transgender Day of Remembrance. So those are some things I wanted to get out right at the beginning of this conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Gigi.
Yeah. Ooh, I am doing everything in my power to keep my emotions in check. As I was listening to both of you about the 10 stages of genocide and what our trans community has already gone through, what you went through in the 80s, especially. And I see the news, and I see what's going on. I see what's going on in Florida. I see what's going on in Kentucky. I see what's going on in Tennessee. I see the shooting. I see the policies turning against the community, not just against the kids, but I'm talking about the adults as well in some states, including Texas. And I am doing everything in my power to restrain my anger, to restrain my tears, because the whole time I was listening, I saw my friends. I saw the people that have mattered most in my life, that I couldn't imagine my life without them. I saw my own struggles. I see my friends who've got kids, and they're coming after us. And they're treating us like the villains. They're treating us like the monsters. No. You know, we're not trying to pull this same stuff on anybody else. Why are you going after us? Because we're different. And I've known what it's like to be different my entire life. I have known. I've known from day one when my mother was told by a doctor I'd never have a normal life. I'd never walk. I'd never talk. I'd never do this. I got over it. I showed them wrong. And then I went into school and I was put in this. I was put in special ed because they didn't know how to handle somebody who was on the autistic spectrum in my town. And I was made to feel little then. But my mother held me up. And she kept me up. And she said, I have pride in myself and fight for that. Fight to show your visibility. And the best way I've honored my mother since she passed 25 years ago is to continue that visibility. And things are so awful right now and they're scary and it just makes me angry. It makes me hurt. It makes me cry. It makes me think about the people that I couldn't bear losing because of some idiot in Washington who's playing, or in any state capital, is playing games with our lives. And I'm going to have to stop there because I am just, I've got to let my anger down a bit, but I just wanted to share that. And I will fight against it. And I will talk to my politicians and encourage, like you all said, encourage people to write out to their local leaders. We can't let this happen.
Thank you. Carter, would you like to share your first thoughts in response to Nicolette's, into Nicolette's work?
Yeah, I'm trying to not cry. When I was 14, I was going to this church, and now being out of it and working with my therapist and my friends knowing about these situations that had happened in this church, it really made me recognize that, like, I was being brainwashed as a 14-year-old. And that was the first time I had heard about the trans community was in church and them saying how trans people were horrible and that we were confused and demonic. And I had went to one of their women's conferences because at that time I was identifying as a girl, and I went regularly to these conferences. And at two of these conferences, I was called up in front of everyone, which was hundreds of people, and they told me that I would never be a boy, I would always be a girl, and that the abuse that I faced is what is turning me into a man, but I will always be a girl, so I just need to get over the trauma that I experienced, and I would be a girl again. And they just kept saying that I had a demonic spirit inside of me that they had to get rid of, that I would become a demon, and that the spirit will follow me unless they pray for me. And the second time this happened, there was even more people there, and I was surrounded by like 30 to 40 women behind me, so I couldn't leave. And I was in front of everyone, and the pastor and her daughter, the assistant pastor, pushed me to the ground and was yelling prayers and telling the demon to get out of my body. And I didn't know what else to do than just sit there, because I was so scared as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, that something bad was going to happen to me if I decided to leave. And that was the like first experience that I had of hatred against the trans community. And at that time, I was just questioning myself. I didn't even know what being non-binary was, but I definitely didn't feel like a woman. I didn't feel that I would live life as a woman and grow up to be a woman. And that's something that I was certain of, but I didn't know anything else about my gender identity. And the only people that I told were two of my friends and the pastors at the church, because church was a big part of my life. And for the incident to happen, and they also posted this to YouTube, so this will haunt me for the rest of my life, of being told that I am demonic and that they would rather me die than live as who I am.
Thank you. Thanks everyone so far for sharing your thoughts. I'd like to chime in a little bit now. So first of all, this is not the first time in history, even though we're not, like, the idea of transgender people as something that's a large social entity, like large enough to actually have a culture and an identity and kind of a movement. This isn't the first time in history that we've existed, like this really short time since, you know, maybe the late 70s. transgender people have been targeted for genocide before. Of course, as Nicolette pointed out when talking about the history of how Jewish people were targeted, during the Nazi period, transgender people were targeted too. And in order to understand how there were even transgender people or how they became targets of Nazis, you have to understand that in the Weimar Republic in the 1920s was actually when a lot of really groundbreaking work was done in Berlin and in Germany, because in the 1920s, Germany was actually the most progressive place maybe in the world. I mean, there was so much happening in Berlin in the 1920s, so much social experimentation, so much liberation. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Cabaret. Cabaret is a really good movie that gives you a small sense of what life was like in Germany before the Nazis began to rise to power. And it kind of tracks. Cabaret is really interesting. I mean, it's a movie you should watch if you want to learn more about the subject, because it shows how slowly over time fascism very slowly creeps its way into a society, and how the first groups that it targets are actually sexual minorities, or what it considers to be sexual minorities. And Weimar, Germany was where the first institute where transgender surgeries were performed happened, where people began to try to undertake a scientific study and, you know, try to find ways to support transgender people in medical transition. So even though the ideas that were around in the 1920s in Germany were, you know, they seem fairly unsophisticated compared to what we understand now about transgender folks, they were still like light years ahead of the rest of Europe. And that group of people was one of the first targets of the Nazis. So when the Nazis went after all kinds of people that it considered undesirables in Germany, one of the first people that they went after were transgender people. They went after the institute where this was happening. They burnt the books, you know, they arrested people, and they basically destroyed forward progress on this for almost 20 years. If you want to learn more about this subject, we did an interview here on Transpositive last summer with a professor from Berkeley who talked about the medicalization of gender and the history of the medicalization of gender in clinics in the West. And the study begins in the, it mostly frames itself within the 1950s, but it uses as its pretext and understanding of what happened in Germany in the 1920s. What's happening right now in the United States is I'm not sure, what stage would you say we're at right now, Nicola?
I would say we're at stage 8.
Stage 8, wow. Oh my God. Oh, okay. Well, stage 8, okay. So, I mean, it's so if you look at some of the press, I was, you know, in preparation for the show, I did what I always do. I look at a lot of, I look at a lot of press. I mean, I listen to a lot of press too. So I cover, I have the very unfortunate task of covering right-wing media in order to sort of understand how people are framing transgender people from a right-wing perspective. And I would encourage any of you who can stomach it and who can handle it, try listening to some right-wing media and try to understand how the right is framing us right now, because they're framing us as they're basically they're calling us things that, you know, I haven't heard in 40 years. I mean, there's ways that they're speaking about transgender people. I haven't heard it in 40 years. And the right wing is using their vast media empire right now, and their like intricate set of networks to just completely to try to erode the public perception that transgender people are socially acceptable. And unfortunately, the incident that happened last week has been, you know, has really hurt the conversation, because it's basically given them fuel. It's given them fuel to just go even further with their hate rhetoric. And I really feel like after the events of April 2nd, or I can't remember exactly what day it was. It was right around then. maybe it was April 3rd. The events right around April 3rd basically just completely, it basically gave these people who have been priming the pump for like just a complete fascist move against transgender people, it basically gave them what they felt like was a green light to use every kind of rhetoric that they can to instigate violence against transgender people. And I think that that's what their agenda is right now. I mean, I think they're trying to instigate violence in any kind of way that they can, and they're doing it to build up their own political power. I mean, they're doing the same thing that the Nazis did. The Nazis were able to build so much power by taking a group of people who had suffered a lot historically. The German people really, really suffered after World War I. And they used the hatred of a very small minority group to fuel all of their rise in power. And part of what they did was they created chaos. So, you know, the right wing does that right now. They're spending a lot of time creating social chaos. They're taking, you know, they're taking away the rights of people to even have their votes represented, as they did in Tennessee last week when they took away the representation of hundreds of thousands of African Americans by disenfranchising two elected representatives who were speaking out against gun violence. They also do it by gerrymandering, you know, the districts, like you were talking about, Nicolette, by manipulating the vote. They basically go after every way that they can to take away the idea that we live in a constitutional democracy. And at the same time, they tell people, oh, you do live in a, you know, you do live in a representative democracy. And they, you know, they tell people lies and things that aren't true. They create propaganda, which is exactly what they're doing right now. They're taking all of the hard work the transgender people have done for the last 20 or 30 years, and they're turning it against us. And they're doing it by creating propaganda. And it's the kind of tropes that we've basically been fighting all our lives, especially those of us who are a little bit older. You know, we've been in this since we were kids and we understand what a long, long road it is just to get to the point where we can liberate ourselves, let alone all of the amazing work that so many brave people have done in liberating our entire community, such as the work of the National Center for Transgender Equality. And now they're trying to roll all of that back with their propaganda. And their end goal is to, you know, really to erase transgender people. I mean, just like they want to erase women. They want to erase transgender people. They're going after transgender kids. They're going after doctors who provide services to transgender people. They're using laws to create fear and intimidation. And they're also, lately, they've been using violent rhetoric because one of the ways of controlling transgender people is by inspiring acts of violence against transgender people in the media and saying, oh, I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything. All I did was say such and such and such. But that person who attacked the transgender person, they did that on their own. I don't have anything to do with that. And that person, you know, is a psycho. I mean, that's what they say. But everything in their speech has instigated and, you know, basically given permission to their listeners to take out violent acts against transgender people. And that's what they're doing right now. And they're hiding behind what they consider to be their free speech rights. And we have to take those rights away. I mean, we cannot allow people to get on the airwaves and to say that transgender people are this, or transgender people are that, or all transgender people are this, or all transgender people are that. You know, those things that they say that are completely untrue and baseless and that are hate speech. And we need to call those things hate speech. And if you use hate speech on the public airwaves that are controlled by the FCC, then you should be removed from the air. And that's one small step that we can do to turn the tide on this transgender genocide. Nicolette, what are your thoughts based on what people... Sheila, before we go to you, I'd like to bring it back around to Nicolette to kind of, you know, give us her response to what we've said so far.
Right.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. And like you were saying, Emma, that is actually mentioned in one of the preventive measures to prevent genocide by Stanton, is banning hate speech and removing radio stations, TV stations, etc., that spread hate speech and propaganda, shutting them down. And I think that is a step that we absolutely need to take right now. So thank you for bringing that up. And also thank you for bringing up that trans people have been the target of genocide before. And a lot of people are in denial of the fact that what's happening in the US right now, there are a lot of parallels between the current state of the US and Nazi Germany or pre-Nazi Germany. A lot of things that were happening then are happening right now. And the reality is, there could be another Holocaust, basically. There could be more genocides if we don't act now. Go ahead, Sheila.
Okay. Thank you so much. Here's some other thoughts. I appreciate the reference to what went on during Nazi Germany, because the institute that was mentioned was run by Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, and he was both Jewish, and the institute was to study sexuality in its broadest perspective. And so as part of that, it dealt with sexual minorities. And they did, in fact, it began as a university students raiding the institute and vandalizing it and burning the books. And then later, the government basically said, well, see, this is this natural outrage of German culture to try to defend itself against what they called decadence. And decadence, certain terms are used again and again. We should never lose track of the idea that we use symbolic language as the means to go after select people. And what a classic example from those days was the concept of degeneration, which was part of a program called eugenics. And the idea was that the human genome is basically constantly improving, except that there are certain characteristics, whether racial or sexual, that are in a sense backward looking, the human race devolving backward to a prior form. And so the type of genocide that we're talking about always has an idealized image of what they feel is a perfected state of either a culture or a people or a nation or even of the human race. And so words like degenerates or degeneration were code words to be used against people like us. And so the other thing is that we have lost track of the ability to dominate these narratives anymore. They're bigger than us. It has emerged way beyond our private efforts to actualize our own lives in a therapeutic setting. Whether we like it or not, it's bigger than we are, and we can't control it any more than the people that are against us can. But the one thing that always is a helpful defensive measure is to make friends with other people, to constantly show that we are not alone. And so we create a sympathetic zone around us where people say, what if this was happening to you? And when people can identify to some extent with our experience, it becomes that much harder to isolate and then destroy us. So making friends is very important. And the very breadth of the narrative that the other side has mounted against us is so extensive and implies so many other rights of privacy and the ability of a doctor to deal with us in a therapeutic setting, that we have whole organizations that have taken our side because they have to. It's part of their responsibility as professionals. And so the very hysteria of the assault mounted against our community actually works against them in the long run. So although if we try to say, well, we want you to disappear, then they say, oh, well, see, you're the genocidal people. You won't let us express our point of view. And the fact that it's hateful and vicious and undereducated never dawns on them, of course. The idea is we can spew any kind of viciousness that we want. We should be able to walk away free and clear. I say, there's all kinds of things on free speech law that says, no, there are certain things that you cannot do. You can't, the classic example is yell fire in a crowded theater. And what really troubles me is when supposedly, institutions that we respect, particularly religious institutions, pave the way on occasion, not all of them, but many pave the way for this type of rhetoric by adopting this absolutist idea that everything was settled in Genesis. And the other thing that's used against us quite often is the idea that this is genital mutilation. This is not reconfiguration. This is not something carefully done. It's not done. They also imply that it's done with very little knowledge. And this is where they bring in the detransition narrative. Says, well, see, too many people are making decisions that they're not able to make. And that does occasionally happen, but it's not the majority. And it undercuts the credibility of the medical establishment to call them mutilators. But this is the kind of words that are used. So we have to be very careful when we look at the language that they employ against us, because one of the most other classic ones is grooming. By definition, grooming is something that's meant to be so subtle that gradually you work your way into a position of trust on a very personal level. There's no such thing as public grooming. It's a contradiction in terms. Grooming, by its very nature, is meant to be private and secretive. It's not meant to be a drag show right up in front of the entire population and with the parents consenting and being right there with their children. That's not grooming. So this is the craziness of the types of, but see, you have to unmask these inappropriate metaphors, and that's a very difficult process, to unmask a metaphor. But when, in a sense, these battles are linguistic battles in the end, because, and this is why every time you meet a person as a transgender person and say, see, I'm like you, and I'm a success in my life. And this is the other thing, is that the idea is that, oh, these people are ghetto people. These are people that you'll never meet in daily life. It's so helpful that when we have success in our community and when we have people that are very attractive, not that beauty should be everything, but the mere fact that any of us can be very beautiful and very accomplished in our chosen gender is another way of saying you can't always use things that are calling us freaks or calling us ugly or using any other kind of opprobrious term against us, because we have exceptions to that. We have many people that have been very successful in their careers. And every success that one of us has is an inspiration to those of us to say, don't let them marginalize you. Don't let them create self-hatred that makes you the adjunct to your own extermination, which is the most dangerous thing, is that through depression and fear and self-loathing, that they can put us in a position where suddenly we are our own executioners. And that's the worst kind of genocide of all.
And I just like to add, just to clarify that, you know, Sheila's points are her points and they're completely valid. But on transpositive, we look at things from a wide, wide spectrum. So there's lots of different kinds of standards of what people consider beauty, and what one person considers beautiful, another person may not. And we definitely support body positivity and consider all different kinds of trans bodies both beautiful and desirable.
Yeah, thank you everyone for sharing your thoughts and your experiences. I think all of you have pointed out ways that we are experiencing these stages right now, like the way that we're being called freaks, or in some people's cases being called demonic. That's stage four, dehumanization. The way that all this hate propaganda is basically saying that trans people are dangerous, that's stage seven, that's preparation. The polarization of the us versus them, you know, if you support trans people, you're just as bad as they are, that's stage six. So we are experiencing all these stages simultaneously right now. It's all happening at the same time, and it is just going to build. And that's why I wanted to do this show, because it's important that we act now. So thank you everyone for sharing your experiences.
And thanks. I'd like to give everybody a chance to just kind of give a quick, less than 1 minute wrap up, starting with Carter.
I'm just speechless about everything that is going on, and it's so overwhelming. And I have friends who live in different states who are debating on moving because of all the things that is happening. And I have a friend in Florida, and I am so worried for him. So it's just, it feels so unreal, but it's so very real.
Thank you. Gigi?
Yeah. You know, like I said before, I'm just trying to process this the best way I know how. But, you know, I always look for a positive way to fight this. And really, I just believe that if we go after our politicians, go after these hate propaganda groups that are, you know, speak the truth about what they're doing, and, you know, really hold on to our rights, fight for our rights. And, you know, I would also say, watch out, you know, when we're going out, watch them, you know, go out in a pair, go out in a group to protect each other. But really, there is a way to fight this, and we have got to bond together closer than ever.
Thank you. Sheila?
Yes, I wanted to make the point that the stages are not temporally linear, that people are at different stages of this, and just because they move on to an advanced stage doesn't mean that they're still using the prior stages also, because that's, it's, in other words, it's a simultaneous process, and they'll never, whenever they feel like they've gone too far, they'll back up a few steps and say, well, maybe I went a little far here, but we're not really going to go genocidal. But what we are going to say is that these people need to just go back into the closet. That's all we ask them to do, is just disappear. We don't want to kill you. Just don't be in our face, basically. And see, that's that denies the fact that invisibility is itself a form of genocide.
Thank you. And I just like to say that the rights that we've won are hard-won rights, and they're easily lost. Democracy is never a guaranteed right. It's never guaranteed, and it's, as we've seen time and time again in history, it's easy for a democratic society to fall victim to fascism. And I hope that we are strong enough to fight this wave of hate that is enveloping our country right now.
Thank you for being here, everyone. Thank you for joining in this discussion tonight. And I hope that everyone listening feels empowered to do something about this current state. So have a good night, everyone. We will see you next time on Transpositive. Stay safe.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
They call it climbing, and I call it visibility. They call it fullness, and I call it visibility. They call it way too rowdy, I call it.
are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kboo.fm/earthday.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.